former Mossad chief admits that the Israeli regime is enforcing an apartheid system in the occupied Palestinian territories. United Nations Secretary General says systematic repression by junta leaders is crushing Myanmar's hopes for democracy. And Russia condemns a U.S. plan to provide Ukraine with depleted uranium ammunition as a clear sign of inhumanity. Welcome to World News, right here in our international headquarters in Tehran. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Appreciate you being with us. Well, the former head of Israel's spy agency, Mossad, admits that the regime is enforcing an apartheid system on the occupied West Bank. Earlier in our news review program, we discuss Israeli crimes with our guests. Let's take a listen at what they had to say.
On this segment of the program, a former head of Israel's spy agency, Mossad, admits that the regime is enforcing an apartheid system on the occupied West Bank.
Let's say there is a car accident between a car of a Jewish settler and a car of a Palestinian who lives in Hebron or Nablus. Each one of them stands before a different legal system, one under the military legal system and the other the civilian system. In a territory where two people are judged under two legal systems, that's an apartheid state.
Parda warned that the greatest catastrophe awaits Israel as it's reaching a place similar to South Africa, a reference to an apartheid regime there. He becomes the latest former senior official to highlight that the regime's treatment of Palestinians amounts to apartheid. Pardo served as Mossad chief from 2011 to 2016. In the past, other retired officials warned about Israel's becoming an apartheid regime. However, Pardo's comments seem more frank and are akin to accusations by international and Israeli rights groups. They argue that Israel gives Palestinians a second-class status in order to uphold the hegemony of Zionists. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have Mona Kandil, who's joining us from Ramallah. Also, we have Palestinian writer and political analyst Jaffa Rimini, who's joining us from Perth. Welcome to the program, to the both of you. Mona, two issues here. First of all, the recent acknowledgments by the former Mossad chief about enforcing an apartheid system in the occupied West Bank. Walk us through the comments made by the former Mossad chief. Also, if you may, give us more details about the recent incident that the UN has demanded a probe into, and that was the forced stripping of five Palestinian women by Israeli soldiers during a raid in the occupied West Bank.
Well, the former chief of the Israeli Mossad, Tamir Pardo, accused the Israeli regime of enforcing an apartheid system in the occupied West Bank, and thus he became the latest former senior Israeli official to have concluded that Israel's treatment of Palestinians in the occupied West Bank amounts to apartheid. We have to say that last year, rights groups, including Amnesty International, called for Israel to be held accountable for carrying out the crimes of apartheid against Palestinians. And they clearly said that the Israelis are treating Palestinians as inferior racial group.
Thank you, Mona. Let's cross over to Jaffa Rimini in Perth. Mr. Rimini, let's talk about the recent acknowledgement by a former Mossad chief. This is nothing new, of course. It's not surprising. More revelations of the apartheid system of the Israeli regime against the Palestinians. Unpack that for us, please.
Look, it is apartheid. And it has been for a long time. And this apartheid regime was enshrined in law in 2018 by the nation state law, which states that Israel is not a democracy for all its citizens, and the self-determination in Israel is exclusive to Jewish citizens of Israel, which means, on the face of it, 2 million Palestinians who are Israeli citizens have been disenfranchised and then be used as second-class citizens. Two, they made Arabic, which was the main language in Israel, into a language of interest. So that is apartheid. Where in the world there are roads that says this road is for Jews and this road for non-Jews? This is in Israel, and that is another trapping of apartheid.
All right, thanks a lot, Mona Kandil, joining us from Ramallah, and thanks to Palestinian writer and political analyst Mr. Jafar Amini joining us from Perth. With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review, but stick around, there's plenty more to come here on.
Over 2 years after a military coup in Myanmar, the UN chief has painted a bleak picture of the current situation and the prospects for democracy in the country. This is Antonio Guterres speaking before meeting with the Association of Southeast Asian Nations in Indonesia.
Since we gathered last year, the situation in Myanmar has further deteriorated. Brutal violence, worsening poverty, and systematic repression are crushing hopes for a return to democracy. The conflict is exacerbating existing inequalities and vulnerabilities faced by women and girls, including sexual violence, forced marriage, and human trafficking. More and more people are crossing borders in desperate search for safety and protection, and the situation is untenable.
Guterres called on the junta in Myanmar to free all detained leaders and political prisoners and to open the door towards the full restoration of democratic rule. Myanmar has been ravaged by deadly violence and military crackdown since a coup in February of 2021. The UN chief also called for the creation of conditions for the safe, voluntary, and dignified return of Rohingya Muslim refugees to Myanmar. Over 1 million Rohingyas remain in Bangladesh, in the world's largest refugee camp. They fled Myanmar in 2017 during a crackdown by Myanmar's military and Buddhist groups. World leaders have gathered in the Indonesian capital of Jakarta for the East Asia Summit amid rising tension between the U.S. and China on a host of issues. The East Asia Summit comprises of 18 countries, including 10 members of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, or ASEAN. The summit is the foremost of the ASEAN-centered mechanisms in the Indo-Pacific. U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris and Chinese Premier Li Qiang and Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov are in attendance, along with the leaders of Japan, South Korea, India, Australia, and others. On Wednesday, China's Li warned against a new Cold War and countries taking sides in any conflict. The U.S. and China have already traded accusations of destabilizing the Southeast Asian region. Russia has denounced a U.S. plan to provide Ukraine with arms containing depleted uranium, calling it a clear sign of inhumanity. Russia's embassy in Washington said the U.S. is, quote, prepared to fight not only to the last Ukrainian, but also to do away with entire generations. It added that the United States deliberately transfers weapons with indiscriminate effects to Ukraine, but the Russian army will continue to methodically grind them. Earlier on Wednesday, the United States said it is sending depleted uranium ammunition to Kiev. That is part of a new arms package worth up to $1 billion. It also includes anti-tank missiles, artillery, and mortar rounds, tactical air navigation systems, and ammunition for air defense systems. Political commentator Fred Ware says the U.S.-made depleted uranium munitions or cluster bombs can't help Ukraine much in its battlefield effort.
One of the reasons I think the United States is sending these types of ammunition to Ukraine is that they've run out of other types in their stockpiles. This was the case with cluster bomb munition. And President Biden actually said that we don't have other ammunition to send, so we're sending them this stuff. That's probably the practical reason why it's being done. But these types of weapons have a long history, and it's now pretty well documented. Cluster munitions, of course, kill people like half a century after the war because they lie around unexploded until some child finds them. These will stick around for probably decades after the war, however it ends, killing people, especially civilians. But will it make any difference to the outcome of the war? And there is absolutely no evidence to show that any of these Western weapon systems that they've been sending, each new thing, javelins, HIMARS, they're talking about Abrams tanks and F-16s. All these things have made no difference to the state of play on the battlefront.
Well, Moscow has decried a U.S. plan to send seized Russian funds to Ukraine. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said some Russian entrepreneurs have already secured court rulings in European countries, finding such transfers illegal. Peskov also warned the U.S. any such action will be contested. The transfer was announced on Wednesday when the U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken was paying a visit to Ukraine. He said Washington would send Kiev $5.4 million in funds seized from Russian business people under sanctions. Blinken said the funds will be used to support the Ukrainian military veterans. Eastern European countries are raising the alarm over Ukraine potentially being pushed into peace talks with Russia. Ukraine's most hawkish supporters in Eastern Europe are concerned that presidential battles in Washington and creeping negativity within the U.S. public toward ongoing support for Kiev will further drive Ukrainians to negotiate with Russia.
As the war in Ukraine lingers on, there are concerns among some Eastern European countries over possible peace talks between Russia and Ukraine. Eastern European countries are raising alarm over Ukraine potentially being pushed into peace talks with Russia. This amid hesitation and delays in weapon supplies to Kiev and waning public support. The countries bordering Russia and Belarus argue that international partners need to lay out a path for a decisive victory for Kiev. Some Republican presidential candidates, including frontrunner and former President Donald Trump, have called for the U.S. to directly negotiate with Vladimir Putin and relegate the war to a territorial dispute.
So we've been pretty consistent, actually, on all this. We need to end this war. No blank check. Europe needs to step up. And anything we do should be in America's national interest. You don't subcontract out your national interests to other countries. And I don't think it's been in our interest to be sending money to pay pensions for Ukrainian bureaucrats and salaries for Ukrainian bureaucrats.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has insisted that any deal must pressure Russia into a full retreat of Ukrainian territory and security guarantees. The concern comes amid calls in Europe to make some sort of a security agreement with Russia. French Foreign Minister Catherine Colonna has said Western leaders will need to build a security architecture that respects Russia's interests when the conflict in Ukraine ends. Reality, history and geography mean that this country is largely on the European continent. We will have to find a way to rebuild a solid security architecture that takes into account the stability interests of all. Colonna's statement does not mark a radical departure from French policy since the start of the conflict. French President Emmanuel Macron has held since last year that Europe should discuss, quote, how to give guarantees to Russia the day it returns to the negotiating table. However, both Macron and Colonna continue to endorse Ukraine eventually joining the NATO bloc, which Moscow would consider an unacceptable security threat.
Meanwhile, the Kremlin has criticized upcoming drills between Armenia and the U.S., saying the exercises would not help stabilize the volatile region.
Without a doubt, the conduct of these kinds of exercises does not help to stabilize the situation or strengthen the atmosphere of mutual trust in the region.
The Kremlin spokesman also censured Armenia's Prime Minister, Nikol Pashinyan, for his remarks that the country's decades-long alliance with Russia could be deemed a, quote, strategic mistake. However, Peskov said Russia was working with both Armenia and Azerbaijan in its role as a security guarantor. in the South Caucasus. Russia has maintained peacekeepers in the region since a 2020 war in which Azerbaijan seized back significant amounts of territory it had lost to Armenian forces in the 1990s. Now, Armenia's defense ministry says it will hold a 9-day exercise with the U.S. starting from next Monday. The drills are the first of their kind amid mounting tension between Armenia and Azerbaijan over the Nagorno-Karabakh region. EU imports of liquefied natural gas, LNG, from Russia increased by 40% compared to pre-war levels. The bloc is accused of vilifying Moscow while at the same time benefiting from supplies which are much cheaper than those being exported to the EU from the United States. Jerome Hughes brings us more from Brussels.
EU authorities did not want data on liquefied natural gas, LNG, to be made public, as it makes for embarrassing reading. Environmental watchdog Global Witness has revealed that countries in the 27-nation bloc bought 21.6 million cubic metres of LNG from Russia between January and July this year, a massive 40% increase when compared to pre-war levels. The European Commission has confirmed the figures, but insists they don't tell the full story.
Since February 2022, the EU has ended all imports of Russian coal. It's reduced Russian oil imports by around 90%, and we've cut total Russian gas imports by around two-thirds.
However, despite its ongoing demonization of Russia, the bloc was the Federation's largest customer for LNG in the January to July period, and there's nothing to suggest that has changed since. Most of the LNG is shipped into Spain, Belgium and France, but other EU nations, the Netherlands, Greece, Portugal, Finland, Italy and Sweden, are also opening up their ports to the fuel. It's then distributed to other EU members.
Russia's financial sector is on life support.
12 months ago, European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen painted a dire picture regarding Russia's economy.
Russia's industry is in tatters.
In the few months following her comments, the EU paid Russia €5.3 billion for liquefied natural gas. Experts we have been speaking to say EU leaders are making a mockery of themselves due to their double standards regarding Russia.
We don't hear anymore Ursula von der Leyen saying that the Russian economy is in tatter because the European economy is in tatter. And if we cut off the gas and oil from Russia, then here in Europe we would be in deep trouble.
Poverty is growing in the EU, and some political commentators claim the LNG scandal is further evidence that those driving the war in Ukraine are highly influential people with close links to the arms industry. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
South Africa has emerged victorious in a months-long dispute with the United States, which had accused the country of covertly assisting Russia in its war with Ukraine. An independent inquiry has found baseless the U.S. ambassador's claim that Pretoria shipped arms to Moscow. Now, the outcome has prompted the South African Communist Party, which is an ally of the ruling ANC, to call for the expulsion of the American ambassador.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي أَرْسَلَ رَسُولَهُ بِالْهُدَى وَدِينِ
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
وَالَّذِي أَرْسَلَ رَسُولَهُ بِالْهُدَى وَدِينِ الْحَقِّ لِيُظْهِرَهُ عَلَى الدِّينِ كُلِّهِ وَلَوْ كَرِهَ الْمُشْرِكُونَ
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد موسیقی خاصی دارد روش خاصی دارد اینها چیزایی لازم نیست
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones
اما این کافی نیست
But it's not enough
ولا تتفرقوا فيه
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن دوری از قرآن از قرآن
Muslims major problem is losing touch with the Quran Quran Quran
کتاب الله
In the limelight.
European household bills have soared since Western countries largely abandoned Russian oil, natural gas, and coal supplies. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to RT, energy prices across the EU have been surging, raising the prospect of higher household bills as the bloc prepares for another winter with drastically reduced Russian natural gas supplies. The cost of electricity in Italy jumped nearly 30% in the week from August 21st to August 27th, reaching 138 euros per megawatt hour. According to estimates by research group Nomisma Energia, starting from October 1st, Italian families could face a 7% to 10% hike in their electricity bills. It cited rising gas prices as the major cause, as Italy is one of the most natural gas-dependent countries in the EU. The president of Nomisma Energia, David Tabarelli, warned recently that if prices remain at these levels, it is inevitable that they will be reflected in an increase in future electricity bills. According to Tabarelli, as quoted by Italy 24 Press News, projections for next winter indicate international prices are 40% higher than current ones and, if they materialize, gas tariffs for the winter could be 20% higher than current levels. Elsewhere in the EU, energy costs have also continued to climb, with the average wholesale electricity price in Estonia rocketing by 93% to 153.39 euros per megawatt hour in the last week. Prices in both Latvia and Lithuania soared 23% to 142.58 euros per megawatt hour. Electricity prices in the EU surged last year following the bloc's decision to heavily restrict Russian oil and gas and fully ban coal supplies as part of its sanctions policy. France, which was once a net power exporter to the EU, had to rely heavily on electricity imports from neighboring countries last winter. Many of its nuclear power plants, which accounted for 70% of the country's electricity output, have been offline for maintenance. According to Bloomberg, France has extended permission for power-generating companies to burn more coal in the coming months in order to prevent shortages this winter. The move comes as the output of utility major Électricité de France, EDF, which provides over half of France's electricity, will reportedly remain below historical levels this winter due to problems with its fleet of nuclear reactors affected by stress corrosion, the outlet said. Tension on the power system is currently lower than at the same period of last year, the French Ecological Transition Ministry said, referring to the prospects of wind and solar output and a drop in energy consumption. However, one must take all measures to ensure security of energy supply for the French in any event, it added, noting the possibility that the conflict in Ukraine may not be over by winter or that the winter itself will be very tough. At the same time, the French government has tightened the requirements for the operation of the country's two remaining coal-fired power plants. Electricity producers will only be allowed to operate for up to 1,800 hours in the coming winter, or about 11 weeks, down from 2,500 hours last winter, according to the French ministry. Under a government decree, coal-powered plants will have to pay more per ton of carbon dioxide released. Power prices in the EU soared last year following the bloc's decision to abandon Russian energy as part of its sanctions policy. France, which was once a power exporter to the EU, had to rely heavily on electricity imports from neighboring countries last winter. Many of its nuclear power plants, which accounted for 70% of the country's electricity output, have been offline for maintenance. Also, according to the news outlet Bild, Germany has had to ramp up electricity imports in the first 6 months of the year after the government decided to shut down the country's last remaining nuclear power plants in favor of renewable energy sources. From January 1st to June 12th, the EU's largest economy relied on power supplies from neighboring countries, the outlet said, citing the cabinet's response to a parliamentary inquiry. Germany can no longer meet its demand with domestically generated power, the report stated, due to a green energy policy disaster that saw nuclear plants closed in favor of renewables. Berlin now relies on imports of electricity produced at French atomic facilities and on supplies generated at local plants in the Czech Republic. Energy expert Andre Tess told TASS news agency, according to publicly available data, Germany has turned from an exporter of electricity into an importer. This is most likely due to the abandonment of nuclear power plants. Germany industry executives earlier sounded the alarm over looming electricity shortages that could endanger the competitiveness of Germany as an industrial hub. The head of energy firm RWE, Markus Kreber, warned last month, "As an industrial location, Germany has a serious problem. We don't have as much energy available as we need. This gap leads to high prices and thus to justified concerns about competitiveness," he said, adding, "We are seeing the first signs of deindustrialization." According to RT, Germany pledged to abandon nuclear power after Japan's 2011 Fukushima catastrophe. In April, Berlin shut down its last three nuclear power stations, ending a six-decade nuclear program in favor of fully renewable electricity generation by 2035. The initial plan was to use more Russian gas during the transition period via the Nord Stream pipelines, which were built to deliver cheap fuel from Russia. Prior to the conflict in Eastern Europe, Germany met up to 40% of its demand with gas from the sanctioned country. However, the sabotage of the natural gas pipelines and Western penalties imposed on Moscow prompted Berlin to search for alternative supplies. Last year, Berlin replaced some of its Russian gas with imports of LNG from the West Asia region and the U.S. But economists have warned that it would take years for Germany to fully substitute Russian supplies with other sources of energy.
Hidden Files. I grew up in the United States with a counting song that went like this. One little, two little, three little Indians, four little, five little, six little Indians, seven little, eight little, nine little Indians, 10 little Indian boys. Now this was supposed to be a song for kids to learn how to count. And the other part of it is they dive in the boat, and the boat turns over. 10 little, 9 little, 8 little Indian boys, and continues. If one thinks about what is being said, it is shocking. But as a kid, I just mimicked the lyrics like the other kids, not realizing the overall effect. I also grew up being shown Indian savages on Westerns and how the poor white man just wanted to live in peace and develop the land that he had discovered. But the Redskins would not let them live in peace. This is the other process, meaning dehumanizing people. And these are just two examples of the way the original inhabitants of North America, the natives, were demonized and discounted, even up to this day, in what is now the United States. From the time the European colonizers stepped foot on that land, the white man saw the natives as less than themselves. They were less human, less smart, less civilized, less deserving, which led to the invaders being able to forcibly remove and exterminate much of the original population of the land a lot easier. Hello and welcome to Hidden Files. Today we will be looking at the original inhabitants of North America, the natives. I am Marzia Hashimi. Welcome. Well, the natives had lived on that land for tens of thousands of years. In 1492, when Columbus actually landed there, there were 112 million indigenous people. 112 million indigenous people. Keep that number in mind, because as we fast forward and we go to 1650, we have gone from that number of 112 million to 6 million people. Imagine that by 1650.
Unfortunately, the tragedy is so multifaceted. We look at then from between 1776 to 1887, and 1.5 billion acres of native land was stolen. This is the story, only part of the tragedy of the natives. Well, from being free to roam and live on over a billion acres to being forced to live on reservations, this became the reality for most natives who didn't die at the hands of the colonizers. Reservations were set up by the whites to control the native population, while at the same time more of their land could be stolen. Harsh measures were implemented, and brainwashing and miseducation were techniques used, as well as the Christianization of the natives on the reservations. Now, the land that the Europeans forced the natives to live on usually was not as fertile as the land they were used to having, or was the type of terrain that they were not familiar with. And many different tribes were thrown together on a reservation, not giving thought to if they were friendly with each other or if the tribe was used to farming or not. We're going to look at the role reservations have played and continue to play in the oppression and attempted elimination of Native people with my first guest.
Bleak.
Oppression.
Small.
They're beautiful and sad at the same time. It's beautiful because you're surrounded by people that are just like you. But it's sad because everything that affects big cities, whether it's drugs or alcohol, or everything's magnified on a reservation. You see it up front, like in your face.
Sick? You know, there's alcoholism, there's abuse, there's domestic violence, there's a lot of things that go on a reservation that really goes overlooked.
Just a compromise. It was an agreement based, well, forced agreement probably, that Native Americans were put kind of out of the way, out of sight.
Man, prison. It's like where we were trapped.
It's the most common misconception about reservations.
That there's some kind of abundance, that Natives are happy, that they're caring for each other, that they live in some ancient way.
Ooh, sad.
Poor.
A concentration camp. Reservations were made to isolate Indian people and hope that we would die off.
Depressing.
Unfair. Because they're not as good as other lands. They're the land that the government and people don't want.
Trapped? It wasn't great farmland, it wasn't great homeland, and so it kind of feels like a place off to the side.
Even to this day, the natives are fighting for rights, to keep the little what they have.
There are no good reservations. Here's your reservation. You can't go across that boundary. This is your reservation. And I grew up on a Navajo reservation, and we're one of the few lucky people that got to remain where our homelands are. But there are other reservations where people were forced there, and they can't fend for themselves like they used to do in the old days. You can't hunt anymore, you can't fish anymore, because you're just stuck on a reservation on these substandard housing, living in third world country conditions. Youths killing themselves because there's no future, there's no hope. That's a reservation to me.
Very sad indeed, and one which hopefully makes us think of what Native Americans have gone through and what they're going through even right now at the hands of this white settler colonial entity. Well, let me get our first guest on to this program to give us a first-hand perspective of all of this.
Juan B. Mancius. The tribal chairman of the Carrizo Comecrudo tribe, Juan is the eldest born to a lineage of hereditary chiefs of the Carrizo Comecrudo, but also descends from the Tasuki Pueblo and Kikapo nations. He has held leadership roles as an assistant tribal administrator with the Kikapo traditional tribe of Texas and the tribal administrator of the Scotts Valley Band of Pahwa Indians of California and the Alabama Coushatta tribe of Texas. Today, Juan focuses on decolonizing both tribal people and others. He has written a 12-step decolonization program and presents it frequently at conferences and seminars.
Well, thank you so much for being with us. Welcome to Hidden Files. Can you tell us about the role reservations played in oppressing the natives?
At the very beginning, I think a lot of the reservations that were set up were set to confine and to change our life ways to the lifestyles. And there's a difference between those life ways and those lifestyles. Our life ways are our traditional values and our traditional beliefs compared to the ideals of lifestyles that was brought here by the colonization. And that became very oppressive because we were practically being brainwashed to change, to accommodate, the colonizers that were here. And so for a long time, I think, a lot of our relatives were on other reservations were not allowed to leave the reservation without permission, and that's become commonly most of the undoing of losing a lot of our language, losing a lot of who we are. Of course, then by doing that, they stole a lot of the land.
Well, what are other techniques used by the Europeans, in your perspective, to oppress the natives?
I think that for the longest time, the big oppression here in this area has been, the Spanish mission concept of coming in and trying to, they were cutting our hands and cutting our legs and, hanging us and to try to, so those that didn't want to convert. And that happened throughout the Middle Americas, what is called Americas now. So there's a lot of oppression based on being forced to learn one language and to forget your language. The boarding school system was one of those. The missions of this area of the Southwest were another one of those. To the Southwest and through California, they were very oppressive to who you are, who we are, and they outlawed a lot of our ceremonies.
And what would you say are some of the main problems that natives still face today?
And that's what they did here with the doctrine of discovery. They said if we don't believe the way they do or live the way they do, that they could kill us. And that's what they did for a long time. And here in Texas, up until the 1940s, they were still killing us. And they were finding ways to take away the land, and that's how they did it. And there's still a high percentage of prisons that have a large percentage of people of color. That should tell you something too. But they still want to control what's there. And if you speak very loudly, you get they'll find ways to get you. So thing is that they like their system the way it is, and it's only for them. And for the rest of us are just supposed to suck it up, And that's no longer the question here. I'm not here to make the white man comfortable anymore. I'm here to make my people comfortable. So,
and with that, we appreciate you being with us right here at Hidden Files. Oh, stay tuned. We're going to welcome our next guest to the program right after this.
Terrence Nelson, vice chairman of the American Indian Movement. Terrence is also spokesman for the Oki-Ida Warrior Society. He is former chief of Roseau River Anishinaabe First Nation and has written numerous books and booklets.
Thank you so much for joining us here at Hidden Files. How are reservations still being used today, in your perspective, to repress natives?
Well, one of the things is that you can't pledge any lands, you don't have access to the banks because you can't pledge anything on a reservation land. You're denied access to the economy. So the United States, the indigenous peoples living on reservations are probably, they're the most impoverished people because it's deliberately set out like that so that the indigenous people don't have the money to fight the system that they find themselves in. So it is it's economic repression.
Well, there are so many tragic events in Native history. One is the Trail of Tears, even significant by its name. Can you talk about this event and others that you think may even affect your people today?
Well, on the Trail of Tears, they just rounded them right up, and they force marched them to Oklahoma. And but that was only one area where they ended up doing that. Amongst the Dakotas in North Dakota, South Dakota, they basically rounded up the people and they forced them onto reservations. And then when they didn't want to do that, like there was lots of different highlights in history where the indigenous people fought back. That's why you have names like Sitting Bull, Crazy Horse, and those ones that. Like Geronimo and those ones that have come through history that fought back. They fought back and they were just small groups of people most of the time. They didn't have a lot of weapons and guns and things like that. They basically fought back as best they could. And the United States Army was extremely well equipped. They had all kinds of manufacturing of Gatling guns. They had all kinds of cannons. They had mounted horses and armies and fighting against people that were just essentially had to they hauled their women and their children and their living, and they basically slaughtered all of the buffalo so that the indigenous people didn't have anything to eat. But those are things that people don't understand. Yeah, when you don't have anything to eat, when you have your children, you're looking at your children that are starving, and you're trying to fight back. Well, that's what the indigenous people did. And that Trail of Tears you talk about, that's what they did. They essentially force marched them, and they fed them whatever little that they had, and then they basically just, the indigenous people were falling off and they were dying. It was because when you, as a parent or as a grandparent, when you see these little kids dying, how horrible is that? People don't understand that. The policies even extended to the residential school area, they call it here in Canada, but on the American side, it was called the boarding schools, where our Native Americans were essentially taken from their homes when they were 3, 4, 5, 6 years old and taken to a school run by the churches and run by the, and they were forcibly indoctrinated into Christianity. And they were told that they were devil worshipers, these kids, that their parents were heathens and everything else like that. So that's the way that they were taught. What's tragic right now is that the Native Americans and our people are, we don't know the true history of what happened to our people, because the one that controls history or the textbooks and is the ones that essentially write the books, and it is the Europeans that wrote the books. So the Trail of Tears is not well known in the U.S. school system, and then they kind of come along and they tell these young white people that the Native Americans are dependent people, that they get their free money from the United States government and everything else like that. Meanwhile, nobody talks about all of the resources that are sold to keep the to subsidize the Native, the American lifestyle. So the gold, the silver, uranium, platinum, oil, trees, water, everything that is now owned by the Europeans and sold to everybody else, they don't pay it to the indigenous people. They pay it to the corporations and to the governments that, that sell this, these products. But it was originally owned by the indigenous people.
Indeed, it is a sad story what happens and continues to happen to the indigenous people. Thank you so much. I appreciate you being with us. Well, I started off this program by talking about so-called poems and TV shows that ignore the humanity of the natives. And this is still a problem and is endemic of settler colonialism. When it is said that they, the white man, the European, discovered this nation and that they birthed a nation from nothing, these lies add to the facade of white supremacy. Now, the very roots of the United States were laid by Native and African genocide and displacement. When in its own constitution, Thomas Jefferson writes about the merciless Indian savages, how likely can we expect the change in the way Washington deals with the original people of that land? As violence is the foundation of white supremacy and imperialism is nourished by exploitation, it is more likely that viewing and treating natives as less than will continue. So it is the natives themselves who must continue to demand their rights and not remain silent. I end this program with a quote from a native chief, Hedmat Toyolakat, who said, "Let me be a free man, free to travel, free to stop, free to work, free to trade, where I choose my own teachers, free to follow the religion of my fathers, free to think and talk and act for myself, and I will obey every law or submit to the penalty. Otherwise, it seems that resistance is the only way." We will definitely be continually to bring you the latest on the natives. For now, though, that's goodbye for me and all the crew right here at Hidden Files. Thank you so much for being with us, and let us hear from you, from your corner of the world. I'm Marzia Hashimi.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.